All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Action for Everyone for this here January 7th, 2024. We are coming back after the three-hour opus that was the war film retrospective. All of you that listened had some very, very nice comments to say about it. We really appreciate it. I know that that is an important episode for me, but it's an even more important episode for my co-host, Vice Victus. Vice, how are you today?
I'm so good. Yeah, like that was a great way to both end last year and begin this new year. As we get into today, this year is starting off pretty strong as far as, you know, the action cinema / media goes. And just in general, you know, like we kind of ended on a weird note at the end of the perspective because of, like, you know, the things that are yet to come this year. And just as you've seen this past week in the news, shit is just crazy. Like, I really, literally am not prepared for how crazy this year is going to be. Like, earthquake here, the young earthquake in major urban Japan, like the guy jumping over the judge's bench, like this shit, like Cat Williams going over the whole entire black comedy history, like this weird shit happening like in the span of like a few days. I'm like, yeah, I'm not ready for this.
You can't even keep up with it. No, it's impossible. I went down a rabbit hole this week of the fucking Stanley mug thing. Are you familiar with this?
Yes,
like, I didn't know that this was a thing. I'm like, how can I like, we have gone fucking insane as a society.
It is not going back, but yeah. So I was just like, you know what? I've over the past 2 years, I have kind of come to the conclusion / philosophy of the only way out is through, but I guess now the kind of the corollary to that is that, like, you're not going to get through unscathed. Like, people are fucking gone, bro. Like, in the brain and in the heart. This shit is not good for us. So we're going to get through it, but it's gonna leave us all in a different place. But that all said, like I said, still, even so, with all the madness happening, it's just stuff to look forward to, actually. So, and some of the stuff that we have been looking forward to is so thus far proven great. So I'm anxious and excited in all good and bad ways. That's good. At least we're here.
Yep, exactly. Gonna have a little bit shorter of an episode, although not as short as I was expecting, because before Vice and I get into the movies that we're going to talk about this week, we do have a special treat. We were able to hook up with Liam and have about a half an hour long chat with him from Indonesia. He's gonna give you guys some background on what's going on and stuff like that. Keep in mind, it's like midnight his time, so he was holding on for dear life, but he cares about you guys. He wanted to make sure that he gave you an update. So we are gonna go to that, and then when that's done, Vice and I will come back and we'll talk about a couple of movies.
Yeah. So it was New Year's Eve, and he got there before, and then we had a day on the second to that we normally would have shot, but we decided we're gonna just prep with him and kind of, you know, get our shit together in some respects, because it's a weird week, you know, with the holidays. And so the first day was like a pretty big exterior day. It was the only real exterior day with him, and it was just a ton of extras and, you know, motorcycles and big huge doors opening and stuff, just, you know, trying to give the man an entrance. And it was really nerve-wracking. And I told you this a bit, and also on the Discord, he's just like vibing on Bale's performance in Rain of Fire. He keeps going, Van Zan! And I'm just dying laughing. It's just like making movies with your buds, you know, and like talking about these crazy reference points that when it's just not the normal stuff, you know? So it's, you know, with Eco, it's always, you know, we talk a lot of Terminator 2 and you know, Mad Max and stuff like that. And then, so then, and it was like, thinking Rain of Fire. You just gotta love it, you know? And And so that first day, you know, like I said, it was a very nerve-wracking day because also it's rainy season here and things can go wrong quick. And luckily it all worked out. And so it was a really great first day, and we're just, you know, everyone's just getting used to working with each other. And obviously those two knuckleheads have already worked together. So as soon as they like stand off against each other, Scott just like gets down in the Raid 2 crouch and does it to Eco, and they start like, you know, slapping ass around and stuff. And it's just like, oh, this is going to be really fun. And then the next, so that was a really big day. That's the type of morning setup that like on a shoot you normally expect is going to take your whole half a day because of all the different components. And instead it took like half the time. And I mean, it was always one of the things of why I wanted to work with Eco as a lead is that like, he doesn't leave set. You know, a lot of actors just go to their green rooms as soon as the setup is done. And then you lose this like 5 to 10 minutes of travel with them in between scenes or in between lighting setups or turnarounds and those things. And those just add up at the end of the day to losing an hour. Mm-hmm. And you don't lose it with him because he's number one on the call sheet. He's sitting there. And Scott, you know, loves Zico and likes talking to him. So he's just going to sit next to him. And so it was like, holy shit, we're moving so fast. And then, you know, we're just kind of flying through the scenes that day. And it was a real rush. And so we did a lot of drama. And I was kind of worried about, like I keep telling you guys, like I think sci-fi is, now that I've done these other genres and doing different movies that have different genres in it, I kind of come to realize that sci-fi is actually one of the hardest things to do. And it's just because the frame of reference is like not natural, you know. Mm-hmm. You can kind of talk about romance, you can talk about crime and passion and all these other things from your life, but when you start talking about supernatural or sci-fi things, it's always a little tricky. So I was worried about that day, but I shouldn't have been, because they just kind of keep rising to the occasion. I just think I'm used to kind of working with actors that are a little bit more like, what are you talking about? And these guys are so clued into the same wavelength that I'm like, oh, this is so easy. You know, you can we just have all the same reference points. And so, yeah, that's just been a whole ton of fun. And I, you know, I talked to you about who, plays kind of the co-lead of the movie, and, you know, we're just weird not having any official announcements, but, you know, his name's Ali's, he's in Timo's The Shadow Strays, and that's one of the reasons why I thanked Timo on Twitter, because I had lunch with him in Jakarta and was like, do you know any kids that are like, you know, 15? I know you just did a movie with a younger cast, and he recommended Ali to me, and it was like, holy shit, this kid's like the best actor I've ever worked with. Like he's a total natural star and super easy to work with, and he obviously loves Eco. Indonesian kid, grew up kind of idolizing him, and so it's just a really fun, unique dynamic. And then him with Scott, and him being like cheeky to Scott, and Scott's just like, you cheeky little bastard. So it's great. It's a great dynamic, a lot of fun. And then you know, the past couple of days, they've been kicking each other
a lot, based on the pictures you sent me. there's going to be a lot of kicking in this one.
A lot of kicking and just, yeah, it's a really fun dynamic. And I'm just very grateful too. It's like, you know, we just finished, I think either day 15 or day 16. And I just think it all worked out really well where Scott came into the project, because we had kind of worked out a lot of our bugs and figured out the relationships and like what we do. And, you know, I'm talking about the different people about like action direction and choreographers and like what that relationship is like. And I was kind of saying how it's like, it's kind of different director to director, but in, even ours, it's like, it's different sequence to sequence. Like we have a big fight that we shot the first week that was sort of a classic Uwais type of fight scene. It was like right up their alley, nothing like I'd done before. Then we have other fight scenes that are like a lot more up my alley of things that I've done before. And it's so, you know, it's like a, it's a balance, you know? So to say what everybody knows on every movie, on every sequence is not, it's just not accurate unless you worked on it. You just don't know. But it is always, and I feel like even now, like 3 weeks in, I know what to look for because their standard of like action, like I'll watch the best take I've ever seen in my life. And they're like, one more. And I'm like, what? it's really good. But then other things that I guess would bug me don't bug them. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. It is always like a tit for tat. And I'll be like, oh, can we get more overlap on this stunt? Because I really like to use doubles like for the slam, but then I want to cut into the actor's face for the reaction. You know what I mean? Like I understand, you know, you can't be lifting, you know, people and smashing them through things over and over again. Doubles are a definite benefit, but I don't want to linger on the shot too long, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's different things that I feel like I've figured out now how to do as, you know, in those scenes when we're all working together. So it is a good balance and it is good relationship. And I think it all just comes down to like, you know, having worked together before and worked together on all of the prep and signing off and stuff on all the video boards and making all of those notes. And then just being a real big fan of what they do. I think sometimes in action movies, like if you're shooting in a certain location somewhere, you can get paired with a stunt team that's like not exactly, you're on the same wavelength. So some of those things that we hear about and those frustrations from stunt professionals or whatever, like it can all stem from different things. You don't always know who picked who for what job, you know what I mean?
Right.
But in this case, it was like, you know, the entire pitch for me to get them involved was to be as collaborative as possible. That was what I did in September when I flew to Jakarta and met with Eco and made this whole pitch for this movie. So yeah, it's just different and it kind of changes, you know, from sequence to sequence, but generally it's just like, I feel like any other part of the process, it's like, if you hire an actor you're not a fan of, you're probably not going to have a great time. But when you hire someone that like you love, and in this case, it's literally everybody in the cast I either have been a huge fan of for years, or I'm like blown away, like Ali, then, you know, directing is a lot easier when you're working with people that you're not a fan of, or that like, they're just not right for the project. It's just like if you were working with an action team that's not right for the project, or wardrobe or lighting or, you know, art department, anything like that, I think is just, it's very, very similar. And it just, when things go right, it's fantastic. And in this case, you know, we've definitely had our challenging days. And when you're working with new things, like for me, like I haven't actually done much vehicular stuff. It's always the first thing that got cut in those other movies. Beyond Skyline, we had a whole car crash sequence that got cut. I don't even think I even bothered playing part three, but I've always wanted to do more. And so then I got to do some motorcycles in this, and it's like, oh yeah, yeah, this shit's slow. It's a real pain in the ass. Like it was not, it was fun and it was it's a cool experience, but it's just like surprisingly slow stuff is like anytime you have scenes of like four people walking from one place to another, you're like, this is so slow. And then you can just bang out like pages of dialogue when it's two people. And I think it's also the same as fights, like two people fighting, you know, like, and especially two people like Scott and Nico fighting, you can get a lot of stuff done in a day. It's insane. And just having three people or four people is so much slower. It's so much more coordination, and it's not quite as like focused dramatically. So,
well, and there's so many more failure points, right? Like Pete Lee, the director of Rope-A-Dope, had a great thread a couple days ago on Twitter talking about that's the problem with fight scenes is the more complicated they get, the more failure points you have and the more things that have to be go right. And it increases exponentially. It's not just like adding one person makes it, you know, one person harder. It makes it like three people harder.
Yeah. Failure points is an interesting term. Yeah. It's even like, and that's even like when you're in a group scene, forget about a fight scene. And then all of a sudden a background person like steps into the scene and says a line. Then all of a sudden, boom, boom, boom. You have to create three new eye lines between the other actors that you already had in the scene. And so those are things to be wary of when like an actor who's like, you know, kind of a one line type guy is like, what if I said this? And you're like, oh, that could be good. No, don't listen to them. That'll make your day much more complicated. But yeah, failure points is a great way of putting it, but it's also just, I don't know, you know, obviously group fight scenes are fun in their own right. But I think filming just the one-on-ones are there's something more energetic on the day. And like, especially, I mean, I guess we already announced that the Yayan too. So it's like just seeing those two guys for the first time together in a fight was like, whoa, it has power. And then you got fucking Scott and Eco again. And trying to do something different, you know, we're not just kind of running it back, from what their fight was in Triple Threat. It's a much different fight and, much different dramatic circumstances, and much different, you know, characters. So yeah, and it's definitely a rush. It's definitely cool. And you know, the stuff about, you know, just talking like Boyka and other movies and things. The two of those knuckleheads together are just like, you know, like at the end of each take, like, you know, sticking their tongues out and, you know, humping the air. And it's just the type of thing you would expect, you know what I mean? Like I said, it's a lot of meatheads making a movie.
That's what people want, though. That's what people are looking for.
So yeah, there's a lot. It's a joy. And then, you know, I just talking about some of the, you know, like I got a voicemail from Scott on the 5th, which was our day off, a voice message. And it's like, oh no, what's this going to be about? Cause you know, I just have like that. If it's a day off and get a message from the actor, sometimes that can trigger like dread. Like, and it was just like, hey, hope you're having a great time with your wife on your birthday. I was just thinking about this line in the scene later this week between my character and this other one. And like, maybe I should offer him, you know, a chance instead of being this. And it was just simple, like thing. And it was like, oh, no dread at all. That was a great idea. And it was all very, very sweet and nice. And it's like,
wait, did I miss that it was your birthday this week?
Oh no, my wife's birthday.
Oh, well then happy birthday, Pat.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It was her last night here, and we had a great birthday, and with the kids, and we went to a different resort that's got like this private pool at the room, and then it also has this awesome pool. So after I went to that resort, I was like, Scott, you should move to this resort. I think your kids will like it a lot more. And so he did, and thanked me. So yeah, it was pretty great. And they left literally yesterday morning. So they came to set and got some last pictures, and yeah, it was pretty special trip. It was nice. It was nice having them here, but I also have to do a lot of work on after work and stuff. So it's like, it's okay for now, but they're still in Bangkok. So they're still on my time zone. So I'm still able to like call them after work, and it feels somewhat normal, but yeah. And like in another week or two, it's going to be tough again, but I'm just so glad they made it out, because that 2 months is like, you know, we were talking about, I was like, I just never want to be in this position again where we have to be apart for that long. And it really is just a part of, you know, kind of we're kind of I don't want to call it, say, working class, but like it's a rich person's job, and I'm doing it at a middle class wage. And so I don't have the money to fly my family out and do as many things as I would want them to do when you're traveling around the world. But you know, hopefully that can grow over the years. But I was very grateful for that experience.
Well, I just thinking about back when I first knew you, and like how we've been talking about this for, I guess, years now. And then, you know, you showed me a picture of Scott and Eco engaged in combat, you know, like it's like the kick to kick. It's just and I just kind of sat back and I was like, this motherfucker really did this shit. Like, it's really happening. It's like a dream coming true. Like, people say that shit and it sounds stupid, but like, that's what actually fucking happened, you know? And I've had a similar experience, you know, in my life, you know, a dream actually coming true. And it's like, yo, like, I don't know. So it's like, it makes me appreciate that the miracles do happen in this universe. It's not just fairy tales. Like, shit really be happening. Like, yeah, So like, but also, you know, just like on the base level, it's like, it's cool as fuck, you know?
Yeah, dude. Yeah. I've definitely had some tears of joy, but like, yeah, no, I mean, even just going back through the show, because you, like you said, all these conversations, and just, you know, I was telling the Discord, I was like, yeah, just like, sometimes I felt like I used the show too much as like my therapy bitch session. Mm-hmm. And then people would be like reaching out to me and be like, do you need help? And I'd be like, no. Like, I'm not that type of person. Like, I don't want anyone's help. I'm not like that. I just, there's so many things in the job that you can't control. And it's just, it feels good to just bitch about it. But then I'd just be like, oh no, I don't, you know, I don't know. I don't know if this crosses into the mental health awareness stuff, but I was just sort of like, no, I'm not looking for anyone's help on this per se. I just need to vent. And it's a great outlet. And you guys are such great listeners about that stuff. But then I was like, I got to reel that stuff in, because I'm sounding too whiny when I would listen back to it. But yeah, I mean, I'm going to spin this around, I'm going to land the plane, is that like, of all those things that I bitched about and stuff, like, I just don't know if anything's as cool as Eco Weiss fighting Scott Atkins. So it's like, it's all just kind of like worth it. You know, I guess even just the fact that like some of those other things were hired gigs or whatever. And it's just like, out of sort of just desperation and inspiration, kind of writing this specifically for those guys, and then getting it kind of put together in kind of short order was really satisfying. You know, I've been talking to Scott since the beginning of this pod, like for cover, and then I don't even know if I've ever told anyone this, but like, you know, he's attached to Skyline Radio like a year ago, and so then figuring out this project. And I went out in September when I came out here and, you know, post those pictures with like Zach Lee and Eco and Yayan. Like, I had half a script and I just went to Eco and I was like, yeah, dude, I'm going to go. I went to the back lot here because I knew I was going to film it at this back lot. And I was like, I'm just going to write the other half here. And I'm meeting with Eco and the manager, and they're like looking at me like I was insane. And I was just like, no, it'll happen. But, you know, it's just had to convince myself it would. And luckily, you know, my DP here, John Riddell, like he believed in it too. And so he put me up at the hotel. Like, I paid for my flight and he put me up at the hotel. And then it was going so well, he extended my trip. So I stayed out here longer than I thought because we scouted and we did all this stuff. So it was like, you know, obviously the producer Matthew Chaus and then John Riddell and Infinite Studios here and me, and just that foundation of all having worked together on Beyond Skyline kind of made this thing come together in a way. But then there's always these hiccups, like there's always these heartbreaks that like and I always, you know, I was always hard to get my hopes up for the Scott thing, you know? So it's like you said about just like, wow, that really happened. And that, you know, having so much fun working with them and them having so much fun working together and it being, you know, so easy. And just like, you know, like he comes in and he's doing the big, you know, having a lot of fun with the character. And then a few days in, it's like, it's time to kick Scott. And you're like, oh yeah, that's Scott Atkins.
But also, I also wanted to make, well, now that we're letting people know out in the world, it also kind of, I'm embarrassed to say it, like, it kind of dawned on me how good you are. Like, the reason I'm on this show is because I knew you get the juice. Like, that was like, you, like, I mean, Mike is cool. Like, we're like, hey, I like talking to Mike. But he's like, come be the co-host of this show. And I'm like, what the fuck for? And like, the guy who did Skylines is doing it. And I'm like, oh shit, this is legit. So like, and then through the course of all our adventures together, actually having this, these Socratic discourses about action and seeing yeah. where your head's at. And then you taking my input seriously. Like, and I keep saying it, like, I don't actually do anything, but for you and your movies, like,
no, we always want to know what you think, and I feel like if you like something, then it feels like it's, you know, it has a chance of being good. So yeah,
well yeah, I just I like that. I'm actually, even just with the few images, just the images themselves, these still images that you show me, I can see like, oh shit, like, you know, because we see online people are like, oh man, I wish what's his name didn't waste Eco and Yayan in Star Wars or whatever, like, or they'd be like, oh man, I wish Scott could do more cool kicks with, you know, like, and I'm like, yo, y'all don't know what's coming, do y'all? Like, this motherfucker got it. Like, nobody, I can't think of anybody else right now in the fucking film world, maybe Jesse Johnson, but like, who can like get it, you know? Or even like you were saying, like, even with what you could tell you about, there's Gareth and there's you, whatever, like
oh yeah, the three dragons, and I'm the
yeah cross-eyed. I'm really glad to be even some way associated with this because I believe in it. I wouldn't be here if I didn't, like, here on the podcast. Yeah, I'm just like really excited for what's coming. For people listening, I get, they're like, you can have inside knowledge, you can like read the script, but I don't want to read anything. I don't want any spoilers. I'm gonna be like, yeah, actually, I'll say that now. Like, whatever happens over the course of this creation, like, I'm going in blind, just like everybody else. Like, Mike has
Except
the
that
details.
you get the set stills the day after they happen. So you're not exactly blind on
Oh,
this
well,
one.
okay, yeah, true enough, true enough. But like, I haven't seen anything like in physical motion, and so like,
Right. Yeah,
whatever, like.
and the set stills don't give away the plot. I mean, right now, Vice's understanding of the plot is that Iko looks fucking badass, shocker, and that you have him and Scott Adkins in a movie and they're gonna fight. Shocker. I mean, really, really not.
Yeah, so like as far as the actual like the plot, I purposely haven't read anything, so I'm going in more or less blind. So like whenever this shit, when this comes out, I'm gonna be there like, I guess I'll be the barometer, I guess. I don't know. Even though I'm biased when your fucking friend, I'm still like, no, it's like you still gotta like pass the
No,
so
yeah, I mean, I think it's I think it's definitely a higher bar than anything I've done. But I think what you said is actually kind of funny. And that's what my joke was last week when I was like, some of you guys are acting a little too surprised, but it makes sense because it was a long time, the Skylines came out in 2020 and I think the pandemic kind of set me back like a lot of people. I didn't get to actually like promote that and go on tour with it and go to those festivals and get that experience and kind of make those contacts. So it just kind of it wasn't like what the Beyond Skyline experience was where I got to tour the world with it. And then, just the things that were getting made, it just took a little time, but it's even interesting now, with that like Netflix and all that the data and that stuff. It just said, seems like Beyond Skylines just had a long like life on Netflix, and so that like definitely has continued to help, and yeah. Yeah, it was definitely much needed for me. I think we were talking about being whiny and then just feeling like, man, like is this even gonna continue to happen? And then, you get back on set your first day and it's a weird job, and to not do it for 3 something years and then go back right into it, and it feels not only natural, but like in some ways I felt like when I was younger, I was just like so happy to be doing it that I would just be like overjoyed all the time. And I still am, but I also now know what I want more than I did then. So I'll still be like, I'll be more mad at myself and stuff if things aren't as good as I know, or if I screw something up, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and go, oh, I didn't get a POV of that. And stuff that I was like unbothered by this stuff before. But I also feel like the type of shit that we talk about and the things that because of this pod and the things it's like anytime there's like a one-liner, like I'm doing the push-in on him and it's and it's like it's going right into his face and it'll be like, I don't need that to kill them. Like I'm doing that shit. Like it's all exactly the way you would think you would do it if you were like just wanted to make something like. And it's not even like it's self-aware. It's just sort of like just the way that I talk about how I like this stuff on the show. I'm just doing it that way. So it's not like tongue in cheek or anything, but it's just like, oh yeah, he's that's why he's doing that shot. That's what the philosophy of all this stuff is. And even the philosophy of the hookup, it's like I've talked to Iko about that at such lengths. He's probably thinks I'm an insane person, but it'll be like, you're just like, oh, we're gonna move on, and I'm like, ah, something was off about that, and we just you kind of f we figured out exactly like what his hero lenses and angles are for these shots. And, and if, you know, it'd be like, no, drop it, tilt up and stuff like that. And just trying to, you know, always make it look that sort of idealized way. I'll talk to the makeup department and I'm like, it's dirty, it's sweaty, but it's sexy.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to, like, I won't belabor you any further because I know you're exhausted, you know, but I'm really glad you came by today, you know, talk shop and let the people know what's going on. And I'm serious. I'm just happy to see you. This is so cool. It's like I have two work husbands now. I had a work husband like when I got the army here. Now I got like three work husbands. This is great.
The funniest thing is, though, I said it to you guys on the message last week, is that like Scott sits down and he's like, I got to call Mike. I haven't talked to him. I got a new number. Can you give a number to Mike? And you're like, you're talking to me about Mike for like, you know, like in Indonesia. And like, you guys have talked. And then he asked, he's like, so is that character based on Vice? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And they're just like, and he's like, are you still doing the pod with the boys then? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, I gotta come on. I gotta talk one more shot, but I'm just so knackered. So we're trying to, I said on the Discord, we're trying to figure out a time that can talk to him and just try to promote one more shot this week. And maybe we'll just run a special pod whenever that can happen, you know, midweek, because it won't be very long, but you know. He's obviously very excited about it, and he showed me some behind the scenes. Some of the fights looks great. You know, I think to answer some people's questions, yes, there's going to be more martial arts and one more shot. There's Michael Jai White in the movie. What the fuck do you expect?
All right, brother, well, go to bed. You're holding on for dear life.
I am, but I'm glad you guys talked me into staying up. Obviously, I can't shut up. I want to do the unfiltered session. But in general, I'm kind of not holding anything back either. It's been really awesome, and I'm happy that you guys are that I'm able to share with you guys what I can on and get your reactions. Today's was my favorite one. Mike, are you sitting down?
I was not kidding. I was rendered fucking speechless. As soon as those started coming in, I'm like, I don't even know what to say to this. Like, I don't know how I respond to this in any way that is going to accurately convey the look on my face of pure unbridled joy that I have right now. Like, I don't know how to do that.
I told you guys a little bit about this, but I just keep saying like in pure Rick Dalton terms, whenever I'm talking to him and he's like, I don't know if I can do that. I'll be like, you're Scott fucking Atkins, man. And he perks right up. Like, oh, I guess I am. Great. All right, guys.
I do have one real quick thing to say, because this has been a very congratulatory episode to you, and I can't go out on that note. The beard is still fucking ridiculous, dude. You look like fucking Mac so. Tonight.
I trimmed some. For today, he came up to me and goes, you like to do that a lot, huh? And I was like, if I don't grab my beard like this, I'd be smoking a pack a day. Like, I have so much anxiety and I need something to fidget with. So, but I did trim some tonight.
There you go. All right, buddy. Love you. And kick ass again. Keep on kicking ass over there, brother.
All right. Bro. Thanks, guys. All right. Love you too. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, and we're back. Hopefully you guys really enjoyed that. Liam is obviously so excited for this. Vice and I are so excited. I don't want to like oversell it, but Vice, those fucking pictures yesterday.
Oh my God. And also, like, you know, when I wasn't joking. Like, I kind of forget how good Liam is, because it's like just those stills. Like, it looks like, I mean, I also kind of, it escaped my memory that he started out as a VFX artist. So like, he has that inherent eye for that perfect image, you know, that's like in the perfect silhouette that we talk about later. Like, you just see what he has there. Just to see the roughest thing looks better than like some shit I've seen in theaters like in the past years. Like, he's that fucking good. Like, I'm not just talking shit because like he's my friend. But, like, you guys, that's part of why he's my friend. Like, he's getting the real deal.
It actually almost looks like he's leveled up, even.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's again, don't want to oversell it too much, but y'all should be very excited. all right. Well, let's start off with Vice. Why don't you take? I saw one of the two movies that we're going to talk about this week. Why don't you take the one that I didn't see, and then we'll end up with Mayhem.
All right. Yeah. So, like I mentioned before. So yes, we're in January officially. A lot of cool things that, at least for our circle of action maniacs, will be great. You know, January fucking over the last few years, as we talked about in the previous episode. There's been a pretty interesting reading grounds for some good movies, honestly, after the, you know, because for years it's been kind of considered a dumping grounds. So one of the things that makes it so good, at least in the recent years, is that we kind of seen the increase or rise of international blockbusters being released here in America. They kind of always have been to varying degrees, but in the past few years, much more so, things like Wandering Earth, or any of the various Indian movies, RRR, Juan. Like, we see them having a big release here earlier in the years. So one of those, and Korea, so always had a presence here in this kind of limited release month as well. So today, or this past week, this released a wide release here in America of Noryang Deadly Sea. And this is essentially the third part or the final part of a trilogy of movies about the legendary Admiral Yi Sun-shin. He's essentially considered probably the greatest naval military leader to ever live, like on the face of the earth, like ever, because his whole kind of legend is during the what Korea was known as Joseon at the time, the Joseon Empire, their fight against the Japanese, who were having a campaign to try to take over both Korea at the time and lead into the China, the empire there. So, and Admiral Yi was like kind of the hero of the nation. He was a brilliant strategist, and through his kind of cunning and naval warfare, and he successfully fended off this Japanese invasion. There was the first. He's been adapted or conveyed in media in various forms over the years in Korea. But I think probably the biggest one of note is the film Admiral Roaring Currents. This came out in 2014. This is kind of this movie, the first movie, was based on he's had several legendary battles, and this one was probably the most famous. It was the battle of, I think it was the strait of Yongyang Strait. Essentially, this strait in the Korea has a very unusual natural property. It changes currents, the direction of currents, every 3 hours. So he used this knowledge of this natural phenomenon to his advantage to basically, it was 30 ships versus 500, and he defeated them all. Like, this is all real. Like, it's like real documented historical accounts of what happened. This kind of genius tactician defeating much larger forces. This film, the 2014 The Admiral, is this scar, of course, Shaman Sick, who was most famous to us, I guess, from a Old Boy. So, like, and I can mention this before. It's kind of like if there's a movie that was like called Valley Forge, starring Tom Hanks, like that's the kind of equivalent of what this movie was. Like the greatest, like the most revered actor of his time, and like this, like the most famous, the famous war legend of his time. That's kind of the idea here. Getting these big name actors to like do this legendary like national hero stuff.
Highest grossing movie in Korean history, if I remember right.
Yes, and just to be clear, like there's some like kind of caveat or asterisk that in Korea the box office is tallied a little bit differently. It's not necessarily by the money or the money value. It's the number of tickets sold. So yeah. So I guess the more accurate thing is like it's the most viewed domestic movie of all time in Korea. But yeah, more or less the same thing. The highest grossing kind of interchangeable in that regard, with very little degrees of separate of variance. But yeah. It's basically the biggest movie ever in Korea, which is funny because, like, part of what we'll get into is that these are it's a myth-making national hero movie, and as we talked about in a previous episode, nationalism is in his DNA. It's what the movie is about. It's about the celebration of Korea, the nation, and so again, like, there's context to that. It's not just rah-rah Korea. Like, Korea's history is very unique, very specific, and unique. It's a nation that has always been essentially under siege in various forms, like either China or Japan or any of the other various barbarian hordes, all that. So like that nationalism has a very specific meaning for them. So just know that going in, you watch the movies, that's kind of where it's coming from. It's not just we're great, it's a whole like thousands of years behind this. So anyway, that was The Admiral 2014. The next film was part two of it. Was a Hans Han Rising Dragon, again another famous battle where again he once again is outnumbered, but this time it's his brilliant strategy of how to use his ships to their advantage to do this great defeat over the Japanese once again. So now this year this is kind of I guess a more direct sequel because Hans Han came out in 2022, and now this is 2020, well 24 now. This is Nuri Yang Deadly Sea. This is the final one of his other. Well, oh, by the way, so this spoilers for this, but like it's also this is fucking history. So so you gotta like if you're curious about the legend of Admiral Yi, be sure to look it up. But so the spoiler is that it's essentially this is the story of his final battle, because that's part of the legend of Admiral Yi is that he was undefeated in naval battle. But he was probably his greatest enemy was his fellow comrades, because the other part of his story that the movies do touch on is that because of the infighting within the Joseon Empire, lots of political intrigue and backstabbing and so forth. So all throughout his career, even though he was loyal to the end, he was always seen as like a either through jealousy or betrayal or whatever reason, he was always an obstacles. At some point, he was arrested, even tried for treason at some point. But in the end, just his honor and his ability, the people realized his worth, his value, and so he was able to get out of those situations, even though they keep happening to him. But yeah, so Nuri Yang Deadly Sea is indeed the story of his final battle, and in several of these, both the legends of the battles and the movies, as I prefer the movies. There's lots like again to bring up to use the American comparison because it's probably the easiest thing to do, like legends like I'll Never Tell a Lie or Chopping Down a Cherry Tree. There's kind of like social like stories well known in Korea that they kind of play through here in the movie. So yeah, but the big thing is as far as a actual period piece war drama, these films. Oh, and I should note that these are a trilogy in continuity. But also in this is all by the same director, Kim Han-min. So it's pretty much the same vision all the way through. So in that regard, is pretty much very little variant in the way of quality. Like they all kind of have the same tone, the same verve of this is a big operatic historical melodrama. So all that entails is very very heightened emotions, very over the top in some regards, over the top characterization, but also very much heartfelt, very much very sincere, you know, like very true. They're very reverent to the legend of Admiral Yi. So, you know, they show him being a complicated person, or at least having dealing with difficulties and but he's still very much the great hero of the nation, and they treat him as such. So beyond the specifics, I'll just say that just the kind of the first half of the movie, more so than the most, well, the movie, the three movies in total, they do take the time in the beginnings to establish the political and also the technical landscape. They're pretty clear on the geography and the who's who. You see lots of names, character names, and you know, the kind of film where it's your character and you have the subtitle of this person's real, they're all based on real people in history. See, this general or this admiral or this warlord, is that kind of thing where you kind of getting the names of the faces and seeing what they're responsible for. So in all of them, they spend a good amount of time, anywhere up to the first third, the first half of the film, establishing what's going on in the background. And then the actual full battle begins, and you see kind of play out all the way through. So the second half, per se, of the movie is the actual sequences of the battle and all the little turning points and tactical maneuvers. It's very specific in details to the actual war part of the war film. It takes its time with the political part, then it also takes time to that all lays the groundwork to let it take its time with the war part of it all too. So yes, similar. So all three kind of follow that same template. So detail wise, it's all, there's not too much to say beyond the spoilers of history, but you get enough established context that you can follow along the battles. For the battles themselves, though, that's where it kind of, for me, it shines. They do, these are big budget productions on their face, but you know, just by the nature of certain Korean movies, they don't seem quite as, the budget might seem quite up to par with you know, Hollywood stuff, but at the same time, it's like what they're doing, what they have on display is still pretty miraculous. It's still like, you know, you still see the giant formations of ships, the various uses of various VFX techniques, CGI, and practical stuff, so forth. So yeah, it is a large scale war film. It's like literally hundreds of ships, cannon fire. They do the whole. They try to portray as maybe not as you mentioned before, not accurately but authentically. They authentically try to portray how battle was fought in that era of the history of the world. So the combination of swords and bows and arquebuses, you know, the old style muskets, rifles, so forth. Of note though, there's the what was known as, or been translated as, the turtle ship, kind of the Korean, the Joseon Empire's secret weapon. These like massive, these massive frigates that had a covering on top of the hull, and cannons on all sides. So yeah, it was basically like a floating battering ram, floating armed battering ram. You know, very destructive, devastating ship. It's really cool, and it's so cool to see it actually on the movies. So yeah, all these little details and like all these technical details taken into account in the war films, and it makes it feel much more alive, much more real than just like, you know, guys swinging swords around and falling down. They very much have, they take those little parts of warfare seriously to bring this kind of story to life.
I remember you saying about the last one that these movies are really for people who like tactics. You know, and the target audience they seem to be for me would be all the people who won't shut up, and I mean this with the most affection, won't shut up about Master and Commander. It seems like that's really the target audience for these kind of movies.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same. Yeah, I don't want to say it's Korean, you know, Master Commander, but like it's definitely like that same vibe. Like, you know, if you want, I guess I'll put it this way: if you want your dad to like watch like four movies, show him this. Like, because this is a dad movie to the core. But it's like, you know, it's universal in a specificity. Like it's very much about this specific unique moment in Korean history. But no, this is the kind of stuff like people who like watch History Channel or read books about war, they love this shit. It's all about that, you know. And it's, again, like it's also the melodrama is part of too. Like it's a bunch of like, you know, things about honor and sacrifice and loyalty and big thing. Like and the kind of part of that's actually part of what's unique about this character or this person. As I mentioned before, he faced many obstacles from his own people throughout, from his own cadre throughout his time. But the people themselves, worse, they adored him because they adored him more than the actual king of Joseon at the time, because the emperor of Joseon was pretty much useless. But Admiral Yi genuinely cared for the people, and like in their defense, and also just like by their welfare, and that was very much echoed or known throughout history, how beloved he was. So there's a lot of when you see the characters, the people, in the movies react to him with this such like reverence. Like it's not really like it's not actually fate. It's not just to, like, kind of blow smoke up his ass. Like, it was just kind of retelling, like, he really was that well-loved. And just in turn, he was that loyal to his nation. Even after being imprisoned and tortured even at one point, he still was loyal to the cause of defending Joseon and Korea. And so much that, so his actual official title, I think the direct English translation is the Lord of Loyal Valor. Like, I don't know how, you know what? It's kind of like another Western kind of comparison, like a, if there was a saint of loyalty in combat, he is that saint. Like that's how strong his character and ethic was in his time, that he's revered as such. So like, yes, just a lot of mythicking and like, you know, some, you know, when we bullshit in this movie, but like, no, the actual guy kind of was that venerable. So like it's hard to impress. Like he really was one of the greatest warriors to ever live in human history. It's like not bullshit. Like there's even several written records after the fact, you know, about British admirals, for example, when they kind of say, you know, who's the greatest admiral, admiral of all time. You know, people, I think in some historical writings, they say we cannot dismiss that what they call the of the Asiatic race, quote unquote. You know, it's old school Britain, but like they admit like, no, he was again undefeated in his battles. He was ahead of his time in tactics. He was shrewd but also he talked the talk. He fought sword in hand and to the very end. Again, this is not back movie. Like this is the story of his final battle where he did indeed fall in battle. But even then there's a great kind of historical legend behind it during the battle. But yeah, so like, yeah, just kind of know going in that there's a lot of like melodrama and like hyped up stuff as you might expect from a kind of a sword and shield war film. But like I think more than maybe any other movie, like this is like the man himself was legit. So like it kind of has that going for it, right? It's a very interesting juxtaposition between like a Napoleon, for example, where like in Ridley Scott's Napoleon from last year, they kind of don't really spend too much time on the strategy of it all. They kind of show you he was a, you know, he thought outside the box. He's also a fucking weird fucking dude. But like, no, like this is, it's kind of the other end of the spectrum. Like this guy was brilliant and also a man of honor and integrity, and they let it show.
Nice. So go ahead. Sorry, Vice.
All right. So obviously, like I said, I don't want to go into there's not much to spoil, but at the same time, the kind of the experience itself is all you see how it unfolds. So, and again, you know, also like read a book, like read about the history, but also like, but actually I do, but I mean that in earnest, because like he is really, we hear so much about like the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae. We hear so much about, you know, the Charge of Light Brigade. We hear all these like kind of the great stories, or even like stuff like as another great, like we hear all these stories about great historical warriors, and more often than not, just from a Western perspective, you know, we get some, we know some things culturally, like in Japan, we know like Miyamoto Musashi, you know, like the greatest swordsman to ever live. We know certain things like that, but the stories from other countries, we hear a lot less. And the legend of Admiral Yi Sun Chin is like definitely one of who's worth checking out, because again, it's not just that he was a great warrior, but he was a great leader, a great person as well. Like from all factual historical accounts, he was that great of a man. And I think that looking into his story is worth it, you know, as you know, like looking at a just a, you know, just a good example of what to aspire to. And you don't have to be like, it's not about sacrificing yourself for your country. No, that's not what I mean. I'm saying a person who commits to the sake of others and tries to live life well, like he's a really good just a good historical example of someone like someone who did the right thing, and though he lost his life, it was worth it, and it was received as such. Just very fascinating individual as to read about in history, and in the movies themselves kind of reflect that, and by being at the very least entertaining, well made, well structured war films. It's kind of exciting, engaging. They want you to look to learn more about Admiral Yi. I think that's probably the best thing of all, aside from being entertaining, is that they want you to really look into the history of this person. So so this part three, Nor Yang Deadly Sea. Like I said, if you're into the dad action, you know, the dad war films, history kind of buffs, all that stuff, you know, you give it a try. It's I really enjoyed this one.
Yeah, I now that this one's done, I think I'll make it a point to catch up on the trilogy this year. I also really like the director's previous movie, War of the Arrows, which is another really good, like, sort of tactical kind of action movie. But yeah, I mean, you didn't need to sell me on it, but you certainly would have sold me on it. So I think people should check this one out.
Especially, you know, like I said, like January, it's a perfect time. Like this is a big ass blockbuster, like in the middle of January. Like you can't go wrong with this shit. Like this is why the movie is so great.
Yeah, it was the same thing last year when they released Pathaan in the middle of January, right? Like it's like, okay, yeah, this is awesome. I'm getting like this giant ass blockbuster in, you know, the worst month of the year. Which as anybody who listens to this show knows, we strongly push back at that sentiment, but. I loved you responding to somebody on Twitter when they pushed back saying, you know, it's still a dumb month, and you're like, The Flash came out in June.
Yeah, I mean, we gotta have Scott back on, you know, for our quarterly review, as it were. But yeah, this past month, the end of the year, like I didn't even see Aquaman. Like that's how much I didn't care, and I liked the first one.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like all this just kind of flew over my head. I'm like, I don't.
Well, I'll fully admit, for me, part of the problem with Aquaman was this doesn't happen very often, but it bombing at the box office kind of sapped my will to see it in the theater, because, you know, I hate going to the theater. Like it is such a chore for me to go to the theater. And I'm like, it got decent reviews. I'm sure I'll like it. But it bombed. It's yet another example of a dead DC property that's not going to continue into the new regime. You know, had it been successful, it might have forced them to have to still keep Jason Momoa, but he's going to be done as Aquaman. And so it's like, I can wait for it to come out on VOD if that's the case, exactly. You know? And people are like, oh, but you don't get the experience. I'm like, dude, I got a Meta Quest for Christmas. Like, I'll throw that shit on my Meta Quest and like get like my own personal IMAX. So I'm good. anyway, all right. Here is the next movie. So the next one we want to talk about is, of course, the other big action movie that came out this weekend, which is Furong, aka Mayhem, as it was renamed here, which I hate, because for those who don't know, Furong is a Thai word of Persian descent that basically means European. It's essentially the Thai version of Guaylo. And that is such an on point title for this movie, as opposed to Mayhem, which is not an on point title. I mean, I guess it is. There is Mayhem, but yeah. Anyway, this is the latest film from French director Xavier Gens, or Gens. I think it's Gens, but somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. And it's really unlike any movie that he's done before. For those who are familiar, you know, he broke onto the scene with Frontiers in 2007, which was part of the French New Wave extremity, along with, you know, movies like Martyrs and Inside and stuff like that. He also then followed that up with his big budget Hollywood debut, reasonably big budget Hollywood debut, the fairly notable bomb, Hitman, based on the video game, in which my beloved Timothy Oliphant, I thought was wildly miscast in that movie. But also has my girl Olga in it. So, you know, I can't hate it. Like you I can look behind me at the Olga shelf and Hitman's right there. But that kind of put him in director jail for a little bit. He came back in 2011 with a movie called The Divide. That's a nasty little piece of work. And he's kind of been working off and on since then. Where this matters is he was hired by Gareth Evans to direct 3 episodes of Gangs of London. And he worked closely with Evans' action team, really took in, I read an interview with him where he really took in how Evans used previs and how the stunt team did everything and stuff like that. And in this interview, and I wish I could remember where I read it. I apologize. I can't. It may have been like Deadline, but Gens basically said he felt reborn. He felt like his filmmaking career was reborn on Gangs of London, and realized that what he wanted to do was to take what he'd learned on those and move into action movies. That he was done with this kind of horror concept, and he wanted to move into action because he felt like he had stuff to say. Now, obviously, when we talk about Mayhem a little more, you will see that once a horror filmmaker, always a horror filmmaker. but nonetheless, so this obviously is premiered in France last year to some pretty good review, not pretty good, very good reviews. And it has now premiered here in the US. It is available it's playing very sporadically in theaters, but it's available on VOD. Vice, I know you have a lot to say about it. I have a little less, so I'll go first, if that's okay. I watched it Friday morning. First thing Friday morning, I got up. Let me tell you something. Maybe not the movie you want to watch at 8 a.m. for those who don't know, the plot basically it involves a small-time criminal who also is a kickboxer named Sam or Samir, depending on where he is in the movie, played by former kickboxing champion Nassim Lies, and we will be talking about him a lot in this, who is recently released from prison. His old life comes back to haunt him. Shit gets fucky, and he runs to Thailand. And I'm going to try and do this as spoiler-free as possible. In Thailand, he sets up a new life, has a new family, the whole 9 yards, and shit gets fucky again. And it's a nasty, nasty, bloody, bleak, violent ass movie. But it is one that I felt was tonally, consistent with itself. It didn't feel like a nihilistic movie for nihilism's sake. It felt like it was a brutal movie, but the story that it was telling was an equally brutal story. And we'll get into a little more details on that. But this is one that I thought was pretty powerful. The only complaint I have about it is I have seen some criticisms that it takes too long to get going. It's, you really don't get a ton of action until the last half an hour. I don't necessarily agree with that. There are some action scenes spread throughout. My only real criticism is they're very short. I would have liked if they had extended those just a little bit to give us just a little bit more taste of that action throughout the movie, just to spread it out a bit more, so it's not quite so concentrated when we get to the end. But other than that, I really don't have a criticism of it. It is, for people who are wondering, it is The Night Comes for Us and the sadness levels of gruesome, when it gets to it, but there is a lot going on in this movie, that is, I think, worth exploring. It also, has 2 very famous Thai actors, that I love to see when they pop up in movies. People will know them because they were both in Only God Forgives. Vithaya Pansingarm, who is the crazy madman with the sword in Only God Forgives. He may or may not be a similar character in this. And then Sajak Bonthanakit, who has basically been a cop in almost every Thai martial arts movie that you will see. He's even in SPL2, A Time for Consequences, and stuff like that. Or no, not SPL2. He's in Paradox, He's in Paradox. You know, and he even shows up in the thoroughly unpleasant and borderline unwatchable Scott Adkins movie directed by my not boy, my nemesis Chaos. And so but anyway, I really recommend this one. I understand it. You got to be in the right headspace for it. I do want to also impress upon people, do not go in expecting this to be something like Ong Bak, because it is not wall-to-wall action. That being said, there is one fight in it that one fight sequence, that I think technically this is a 2023 film, but for I'm counting as a 2024 film, has thrown the gauntlet down. So other movies coming out this year are really going to have their work cut out for them, because this fight scene I thought was just jaw dropping in both technique, execution, and just pure unbridled emotional devastation. Vice, I'll kick it over to you.
I think the important thing to kind of know going in is that this is, as you kind of inferred, this is not a full bore action bonanza. This is a straight up French neo-noir pitch black like gangster ass movie. Like this is like Black Coffee Dispensed to a T. Like it gets that dark and it stays there, even with all the really cool, like fine knees, you know? It's just like this could have been a gangster story without any martial arts. It just so happens that the protagonist is a martial artist. So that violence is expressed in this really clean, crisp way. But he's, you know, like he's still fucking up goons just the same as if it were, you know, a history of violence or whatever. Still brutal, still bloody. And the other thing is, you mentioned this, the criticism about it being slow, or this first half or first two thirds or even are just like kind of slow, where like kind of quote unquote nothing happens. Sorry, or if you're expecting an action movie, you would understand why you would say nothing happens. This is a real motion picture. This is a real story. This is like from the opening sequence. You see that Sammy, we don't realize it yet, but he's in a jail cell. He's in a jail gym yard, whatever. He's doing this combination. So they're introducing the fact that he can move, he can fight. Then a fight next to him breaks out, where these inmates are fighting, and they one of the inmates grabs a barbell and smashes the guy he's fighting in the shin and like crushes it. And you see kind of Sammy, like you see him poised to take action, but he holds back because he's about to get out. He's about to go on parole. This is the first minute of the movie. And then what follows is that you see him, that this first part where this is before the credits roll. You see this story of him, the struggle to like stay clean, stay out of trouble, avoid his past life. But again, it comes to haunt him. And then when we get throughout the first major part of the film, you see his life in Thailand, you see his family, and you see him just kind of working in a day-to-day struggle. Like his day job is, he works at a hotel for tourists, and he's a baggage handler. Baggage handler slash a
shuttle bell boy. Bellhop.
Yeah, he's a bellhop. But then he has to, quote-unquote, moonlight as a fighter to help meet his family's goal of getting money to buy their place for the restaurant to, you know, get better. This is all like classic, like, you know, like working class, rough and tumble, like street drama. Like this is a real drama. Like I think people were kind of maybe not perplexed, but I'm surprised that IFC, I guess the films picked this up. But as I'm watching it, I'm like, oh yeah, this is definitely like this type of independent, small scale European drama or, you know, international drama. Like it's the very same vibe and tone, but just as importantly, this is a real filmmaking. It's not just throwaway setup for an action movie. Like this is a movie with this story, with this, you know, and I say it's a really just in a brief time that they say it or show it, you know, just very authentic, again, authentic, honest stuff about like the immigrant experience or, you know, like, or staying out of jail. Like the fact that, so the character Samir, he is, from what we can tell, an Arabic a Frenchman of Arabic descent. Like, and you kind of see him when he's on parole trying to get a job. You see him working with these other immigrants. Like, he has a conversation with a immigrant from Senegal, and they kind of just kind of staring there, sort of having a hard life.
He's actually, Dan's actually said he's Algerian.
Right. Okay.
And he wanted, he specifically wrote the character to be Algerian.
Yeah. And that itself has a lot of weight, historical weight. Like, these are not hard to explain, like, especially come not of that culture, but like the Algerian experience in France, or at least being or Arabic or Algerian, like, that's a very specific kind of thing, like a very specific kind of racism and obstacle that we see in a lot of different films. Like, Sami Bujila has a lot of films about this kind of experience, and like where what it means to be a brown man in France, like how that this is very powerful stuff that has a lot of weight and context behind it just by them being. So you see him kind of talk through that with a fellow quote unquote outsider, and what it means to like try to prevail on the bottom rung of society. Like, that itself is a movie right there. And then it goes into, like, you know, as you say, shit get fucky, you know, shit goes down, and like he has to escape. And then it becomes this kind of really interesting, like really quiet, kind of beautiful story about being immigrant, being an undocumented immigrant, important part in Thailand, and the troubles that you might face that way. So like, this is just a very really subdued, authentic drama about this multicultural international experience. Like the actor slash character himself, he speaks three languages in the film. Like he's speaking Thai and French, and English. Like, it's,
that's actually one of the things I really, really quick, I love about this movie, and I love it when movies do this. The French people speak French, the Thai people speak Thai, and when they can't understand each other, they speak to each other in broken English. Like, it's a very realistic, it's not one of those movies where everybody just speaks English all the way through, or everybody just speaks French all the way through. They speak the language but most of the characters are multilingual, so you do get an interesting sort of juxtaposition of all of those.
Yeah. And I just, I feel like I should bring this up, like, because I heard this years ago when I was here, one of the, at the New York Asian Film Festival. It was a really nice drama. It was Apocalypse Child. It was a drama, and the story was, there was a man who was, his mother told him he was the illegitimate child of Francis Ford Coppola, right? Is that what it was? Yeah. Who when he was filming Apocalypse Now in the country, like, it's like a kind of a really like interesting like romance love triangle, kind of dark on a dark scale, but like the characters they're multilingual, and the son, the main character, he was speaking English, and his mother would speak in Thai, but they understood each other. And like, just, so I've heard this from people in real life, and I don't want to say they're dumb or they just probably haven't experienced it. That's a very common thing. Like, just so just if you weren't aware, like, there's multilingual families who will only speak, where one person only speaks in one language and the other person theirs, but they still have the understanding. Even though they can't speak the language, they still comprehend it. I just want to make that clear, because like, this is not, some people might think that this is like a contrivance, if they've never experienced it before in their lives. But no, this is like a very common thing. Or like, my best friend is Thai. He's born here in America. His dad's Thailand. He was speaking English and dad's speaking Thai. And they got to the point where I actually understand some of what his dad said, because I was around him so much. But yeah, it's a very common thing. So it's not a weird contrivance for the movies. Like, it's just a thing that happens in the world.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's like, I agree. I think it's again, to use the word authenticity, it adds a layer of authenticity to the movie that a lesser movie wouldn't have even worried about or wouldn't have even thought about.
Yeah. So yeah, just all of us to say, like, you know, this could have been a film, an interesting, captivating drama on its own before it even becomes a gritty crime story. Like, it was just like, I it had the very same vibe that this is kind of what I'm going to go off a little bit, because like, it has the very same kind of tone of like these film festival movies, as quote unquote, the kind of stuff that people will see for, like, you know, they'll see them, these independent foreign dramas, and they'll be like, oh, this is the best movie, one of the best movies of the year. They don't do the kind of stuff in America. They kind of say the kind of the same shit, like they exoticize these foreign films. And not because the films, it's not wrong because the films are bad, they're great, but that's all they see them as. And so this film is that. This film is that prestige drama, and then the moment comes where he has to fight. You see in his eyes, like, it's time. I have to turn this into an act. It's fight or die. And he pulls out the slickest fucking moves you've ever seen. The flying knees and like this really crisp Muay Thai style. And it's like sharp. Like Muay Thai is known for being brutal. Because just the art of eight limbs, the knees and elbows and the hard points for striking. Like, it's very devastating. Even in real life, like professional fighters, they don't, or at least the traditional Muay Thai style in Thailand, it's very deadly or brutal size deadly. Like, they don't really age as fighters. You only the first maybe like few years of your life, like from like your teens to like early 20s, are you like a viable fighter? Because after that, it's so damaging to your body that you can't do it anymore. Like, it's a very rough sport, a very dangerous sport. So there's that inherent brutality in that style, and yet the way he does it, it's so fucking like sharp. It's clean, and it's like it's still this is effective and brutal. But, like, he just like the angles he has when he fights, like the straight arm and the it's beautiful. It's like beautiful. So so it becomes this slick, high energy, brutal martial arts film, and it kind of goes that through the end where he has to proceed to what he's doing. Well, I'll just say again, Buffalo is he's trying to find his daughter who's been taken from him. So he's going on the quest to take out the bad guys to get her back. This is very kind of staple tropes of action films. But that whole hour plus of story of this man just struggling to prevail is what makes that fight, makes this fighting worth it. Like, you understand why he's going to this length to do it. And you even see the hesitation in his eyes where he's like, is this really the last draw? Like, because you remember, you saw him in the beginning. Where did fighting get him? It got him. He had to escape his land. He had to run away. So you see that in his eyes, to like this conflict, to like, do I have to defend myself? And he does. There's no choice about it. I feel like people are giving this movie short shrift because, like, they're expecting this fucking, chop sucky bullshit nonsense, and they're completely dismissing this genuinely authentic drama in the first part of this movie. Like, this is what, but that drama makes the movie. It makes the fighting worth it. So yeah, I I've heard some reviews, from major publications were like, I get that sense that they were because they were expecting chop sucky bullshit. They aren't giving it the same consideration that they would have given the same kind of movie if it didn't have kicks. They would have been like, oh, this is this quiet, calm drama from Thailand / France. They would say some sort of, a joint production, kind of finding the beauty of Bangkok. They give you the same fucking bullshit buzzwords. But just because there's kicks in it, all of a sudden it's bullshit. And I really didn't appreciate reading some of those articles. Because, again, like, it's part of our ethos in this show is like, and someone from our other fellow journalists, like, this genre is worth that consideration. It has that value. It is. These are real fucking movies. This is a prime example of a great story, a great film that then just also has fucking great deadly martial arts in it. And I really think that this is, this is January, but it's already a high point in cinema. Like, even the small parts within the film where he's just like kind of, you just see his regular life. They're beautiful. Like, the cinematography is gorgeous. Him on the beaches of Thailand, and then when he goes to the scummy neon streets of Bangkok, it looks great. Or even when he's before that, when he's in France, he's kind of seeing like the gray humdrum existence of lower class, dude living in France trying to get by. It looks so, and it feels it's so real. You can feel the concrete. Like, it's all there. All that little tactile. The nature of it that makes a movie feel lived in. It's all in this movie. But then again, there's a flying knee or there's a knife in the throat. It has a lot going on. And I think that people are kind of getting thrown off at what they're expecting from the movie. But I really like that it decides to take its time to be dramatic and to be authentic, to be lived in, and then ramp up into this nightmare of violence when it's time. So yeah, I just want people to press upon them that you're going to get, this is what the movie contains. It has these two kind of minds to it, but they all work in concert with each other. It's not a total imbalance. One informs the other.
Yeah, it almost feels like some of the criticism I've seen, like you said, had it not had the kicking, people might have responded. Those people might have responded to it better. Or if it had had more kicking, they might have responded to it better. But the idea that it's an hour of independent drama about being an undocumented immigrant, being, you know, preyed upon by criminals who have all the power in this situation, and a half an hour of The Night Comes for Us, I think that broke some people's brains a little bit. but yeah, I agree. And look, this is, again, not to say, you know, if people are listening, I got my feel bads butt hurt on Twitter this week, because I saw some friends saying something about Silent Night that I miss. People who don't like Silent Night, I misinterpreted what they were saying. And so I got my feel bads hurt, and everybody's good. But you don't have to like this movie. Like, this isn't, but it does feel like some of those criticisms I've seen they're surface level, and they're not engaging with the actual film itself.
Yeah. And to be fair, like the plot itself is kind of, you know, you've seen it a thousand times before.
It's,
you know,
bog standard. Yeah.
Guy getting revenge, or, you know, going on a journey of bloodshed and vengeance, you know, it's common, well-tread ground. So I'm not saying it's like a groundbreaking fucking theatrical event, but what I am saying, though, it is still a real motion picture. It still has its real gravitas to it. But then you choose to use that gravitas to inform these really kinetic, bloody battles. And I think it makes it all worth it.
This is for those of the people that listen to this show that liked the channel. This is for them. This is, it's that same kind of bleak. I want to go into spoilers for just a few minutes. So folks, this is the last movie we're talking about. So if you don't want to hear spoilers, you can just hit stop now. Cause after we're done with this, Vice and I'll do our sign offs and stuff. So you can just hit stop now, but I do want to talk a little bit about spoilers, in 3, 2, 1. Okay, the fucking elevator fight, man. I don't even know what to do with that. I don't even know what to do with that fight. That fight, like, I was basically watching that in the fetal position. Like, it hurt so much. But it was so amazingly well done, so amazingly well constructed, and just, I don't, like I said, I don't know that another movie's going to be able to top that this year.
And so here, also, since we're major spoilers, the people he's fighting in the elevator, they don't really call it out, but those are the people who killed his wife. Like, he doesn't like, there's no like stare down, like sirens going off, like, oh my god, it's vengeance time. He's like, these are the enemy, and he counters them, and as he's fighting, he's like, oh shit, that's them. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of, but it also kind of comes to a head, because like he realizes that this is it. This is like the last stand, basically. So like he puts his whole body, mm-hmm. or he puts his whole body in disregard, like he getting the knife through his. He blocks the knife with his hand. It goes to his hand, and is like, oh my god, like this is it, like this is the end for all of us. Like he's like it's a kind of a fight where it's like, you know, none of us are getting out alive with it. None of us are getting out alive. So this is it. So it goes all full mayhem. It reached the actual title in that regard. It was like,
yeah,
this is doom for all involved. And just it was funny because like the actor, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. I must remember his name soon. Nassim Elias. You know, he's, like you said, he's a champion. He's a real champion kickboxer, and he's gorgeous. He's like a bronze god. Mm-hmm. Like the abs and the arms and his face, he's beautiful looking man, but he has this like kind of physical beauty to him, but his demeanor is very calm, very subdued, but he moves like a panther. He moves so fucking sleekly and deadly is it. And so it was just funny, like I was coming through the film, I'm watching with my wife, and I'm kind of in awe of his physique, and I'm like, he has great arms, he's just perfectly stout, strong arms. And then the movie goes, oh, you like those, huh? And he uses at one point, he gets so injured that his, I guess, radius or one of his forearm bone is broken and pops out of his skin, open wound fracture. And I was like, no, the arms. But then again, like I said, this is the end. This is like doom. the way he uses his arm bone as a weapon. Oh my God! I screamed out loud. Like, I was watching him cut. I screamed out loud. Like, I couldn't believe that I was seeing it. Like this, like, because again, it's brutal on his face. Like, it's a very nasty, gory, you know, horror movie shot. But then all the everything we see until now informs it. Like, he's at his end. Like, he's going all out. He has nothing left. So he's just turning his whole body into this war of attrition. And so, yeah, like, that's the only weapon he has left. He's going to use it. You know,
well, it was just. And then also the nut punch afterwards to find out that he's gone on this roaring rampage of revenge for no reason whatsoever. Yeah. That he could have never gone on this and gotten what he wanted, you know, essentially. And so it's actually funny that I brought up Silent Night, because I do think they play well together in terms of the cost of vengeance and people who aren't super elite. Even though Sam is a great kickboxer, you know, he's not a super elite special forces guy. He screws up a lot. He gets hurt a lot, just like Joel Kinnaman does in Silent Night. But I feel like because this movie did take that hour, and especially took the time for us with the family. I mean, ultimately, yes, the wife is fridged because that's how these movies work. But we actually got time with her. We got to see their relationship. We got to see their struggles. And so it's a gut punch when she does get killed. And that works in a way that I think for me, Silent Night didn't. And then to just have the last 10, 15 minutes of this is so unrelentingly brutal. And I mean that in the best possible way. So unrelentingly brutal that once I got done watching it, I kind of understood why they didn't spread out the action a little bit more, because you couldn't take more of what the last 15 minutes of this movie gives you. Like it would be an endurance test if that part went on any longer.
You mentioned the meaninglessness of it all. Again, like, I should have known going in that this is a legitimate French neo-noir, like, you know, like Lost Bullet or, you know, Rogue City. Like, it's that same tone, that same vibe. It's like, it's still the classic noir, but in this our modern setting. So all that entails, you know, this, even like this high speed, highly formal kickboxing style, all that, it feels fresh, but it's still that same black dour, this world is full, this is a world of shit kind of thing. You know, even the betrayal we find at the very end, the betrayal of it all, like that stings more than the arm stabbing, like to know why that he did that, you know, like it's, that hurt most of all, actually. You can see, and again, this actor, Nassim, I don't know if it's his first role or not, but like, this guy's got it, man. Another Christian I heard, like, he's born, or like he's not equipped enough to do the drama. No, like in the first part of the film, you see him kind of just being like, you know, he has a rough life, he has a chip on his shoulder, but he's still like, you get the sense that he's an inherently good person just by his face. He's a baby face. Then at the one point when he's going to find a daughter, and he goes to the sex shop slash sex bar, whatever. And so to find his daughter, he's purposely going to find, he's asking the pimp mama for underage girls to try to find his daughter. And so she parades them, she brings them out, they parade them there. So you see the underage girls they're sex slaves, underage sex slaves, that's what they are. And you see the disgust on his face, like, wow, like this, like, and he doesn't say anything. He just, you see that emotion and that, like, this disgust of with this world he's in now. And like that was a performance right there. Like, he didn't just have the kicks and the moves, like in the body. He has it. He has the actual juice.
And that whole scene is just, you know, because madam brings the girls out, and he kind of looks, and you can see that he's, but then he doesn't really say anything because his daughter's not there. And so then she looks and she goes, younger. And you can see him, like, he knows he has to nod his head yes, but it kills him to do that. The other thing about this is just as a character work, Sam's not a guy that's going to be overly emotive, right? I mean, given his life, given his history, he's not going to be somebody that's going to like emote. He's going to be pretty emotionally restrained. And yeah. I thought he, I thought he conveyed that pretty well. I didn't really, this is not his first movie. He's actually been in several movies, but this is probably by far and away his, I think this is probably his first starring role. Yeah. He unfortunately was in The Last Mercenary, which is a movie that I'm well on record as hating. But yeah, this is his first starring role, I think. I'm with you. He's got it. He cuts just such an impressive screen presence.
And even like, I think our friend, Matt Esri said, one scene where there's a scene where he has to do a drug drop, and that scene that is filmed better than it, again, like if this wasn't an action film, that would be a marquee scene. Like it's the tension of him in the causeway, almost being home free, but then he sees, oh no, like maybe this is a setup, or this is like the guy at the dropper point is being apprehended by cops, and my stomach dropped, like I could feel the like, because again, we've seen the whole film up to this point, what's on the line for him, why he has to do this drug drop for this fucking crime boss, so we know his entire world is at stake, and to see it so quickly dawn on him that shit's fucked. And, you, and like again, it doesn't. There's no big emotion. There's no emoting. There's no big like. It's not melodramatic. It's just like you can just with his subtle facial gestures and his body language, you can feel like the doom setting in. Like this is over, and he plays it so fucking well. And then just seeing this, the scene itself, we constructed it. Just and then from that realization, he bursts into a sprint like. That panther takes over. That animal instinct of his, that survival instinct takes over. That he does so well. Yeah, it is a lot of standout stuff here in this so-called small low budget action movie. And again, this is why we love this shit. Like this so is gold in this fucking movie. And I think that is being overlooked a little bit. But yeah, but and as you said, this is we're in January. The bar has been set really high already. Like this is the one to beat. Like as far as the next film is. Or even a gangster film, a crime film, or a drama like this, it's already this high. This is the bar. Yeah,
I agree. This is up there. So, all right. Well, that's a good place to wrap it up. So, Vice, where can people find you?
Yeah. So, once again, I'll try to make sure I put my on Letterboxd at Vice with this. I'll try to make sure I put my latest reviews for both this and Noryang on there, and also like, you can see the updates to from our previous episode, the war films of 2023. I'm on Instagram, looking hot as always. I'll try to be in the Discord a little more. So make sure you guys, if you're on Twitter or you can hit Mike up, he'll give you details to join the Discord. A lot of great stuff there. You know, much much better place for all of our discussions. And as always, until one of us dies, I'm on Twitter at BiceFictus talking all the shit.
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Hibachi Justice. You can follow the show at A4E Podcast pretty much everywhere, except if you want to email us. If you're not on Twitter and you want a link to the Discord, email us at A4EPod@gmail.com. We'll hook you up with that. You're listening to us, so you know you can find us anywhere podcasts are found. Vice, love you. Let's do this again next week.
Next week, Beekeeper. Oh, psycho height.
Yep, absolutely.